Welcome to Everything is a Primary Source, the podcast where we get history through pop culture. Today's episode will see us treating the video rental store that you used to have in your town like a world-class history museum, as 1999's Blast from the Past is treated as an artifact of the era.
I'm still glad to have Jeremy Ebersole with me once again, this time to talk about a movie. Last time you were on, Jeremy, we talked about Neon, which you're just saying was your life's passion. And it was the avenue that brought me into the Society for Commercial Archaeology. And do you see any kind of parallel between Neon, Roadside Americana, and what the SCA does in this movie, Blast from the Past from 1999?
Yeah, absolutely. I just rewatched this two nights ago because I don't think I had seen it in quite a while. One of these movies that, you know, came out when I was, I would have been in high school when it came out. Yeah, and so in the vein of those movies and loved it and bought it. Yeah. But I looking back, I can see this thread in a lot of the movies that I like of this kind of engagement with the past and how places change over time. I'm thinking specifically in this movie, which of course is about, maybe for folks who aren't immediately familiar, I guess the very basic premise is a family goes into a fallout shelter in 1962 because they think a bomb has been dropped on Los Angeles, and they set the lock for 35 years. and then the son, who is born immediately after they go into the hatch, lives his whole life in the fallout shelter without any awareness of what's happening up above. After 35 years, comes back up and experiences all of the changes in the world circa 1999 in a kind of innocent, optimistic, kind of Pollyanna-ish way. And that, of course, is charming. And there's a romance, and we all live happily ever after. But in a wonderful story that has been used in many other situations. But to the direct question, I mean, one of the things that happens throughout the early part of the movie is that the home in suburban Los Angeles in the valley that in 1962 is this quintessential ranch house, of course, not long afterwards gets bulldozed and they build a malt shop right on top of it. And then we see the transition of that malt shop from 1960s teenager hangout to 1970s kind of druggy disco hangout that becomes this kind of skeevy 90s punk rock club, all kind of in stereotypical fashion. But in some ways, that's kind of what we look at in the SCA, is how these buildings, how places change over time, and what that says, you know, about that place, about the society. And certainly that is a theme in the movie. All of the humor, the entire setup is about this kind of fish out of water story, and how the 1960s are so different from 1999. Yeah. And wouldn't it be interesting if we displaced someone from this era into this era and they had no idea what happened in between? So certainly I see that in, you know, like just like Back to the Future, another one of my favorite movies.
And I think that really, and that's a wonderful summary of the film, really is what the material is made from. You know, 1999, this was, like you said, this is not the only movie like that where they are doing this compare and contrast between different time periods. I remember when Blast from the Past was being advertised and seeing the trailers for it, and they didn't make it really clear that it was all just a big dramatic irony misunderstanding as to why the family went underground. I remember seeing the previews for it and seeing Brendan Fraser on his character of Adam being lifted up on this elevator, and some kind of mention about his mad scientist father. And so I thought, like, the way that the trailer made it seem like is that it was a some kind of experiment that his father had done, that he intentionally kept his kid underground for no other reason other than to see how well a kid that would get no other influences, like basically all of his education and understanding of the world around him ends at 1962, how he would do in the real world. And of course, like you said, we do get that, but there's a pretty rational, I mean, it's far-fetched, it's science fiction, but it's pretty, it matches the time period at least. I don't know if what Christopher Walken's character does is actually possible. He's like growing fish and, you know, the wife has a full supermarket that she can use.
Yeah, hydroponics, undergrowing plants underground, and which we're trying to do more of now.
Yeah, it's like this was, they really show the best circumstances of what could have come from people's paranoia and fears during the Cold War, during the height of the Cold War in the 1960s. Of making this fallout shelter like better than what's on top of, you know, the soil. So once I finally got to see the movie, I'm like, okay, I see why it's happening, and that's super clever. I really think so. You know, big part of the material is actual history. You know, the movie begins with really good exposition. I like the way that the characters at their cocktail party are talking to each other about the dad in particular.
Right.
And, you know, Calvin. And that, you know, so it's not like we learn about it another way. I suppose they could have made this movie and done an opening montage of him building the fallout shelter, you know, and supplying it. But instead they start with this cocktail party, very 60s, you know, very carryover from the 50s kind of thing.
Right.
And then, you know, one of his friends comes in and JFK is going to go toe to toe with Khrushchev right now. It's on TV. And, you know, that's what sets the whole thing in motion. So,
And the whole opening credits too, with just having these newspaper articles kind of set the scene. Like, we are in a time when we're afraid of nuclear disaster, and Calvin is kind of set up as the this lovable but slightly crazy, like the lovable mad scientist.
It was like he has his act together, and he takes care of his family beyond what would be expected of somebody. And honestly, if he hadn't taken them underground, they would have died. I mean, a plane does crash on their house. So while while that causes him to think that, you know, an actual bomb has been dropped in LA, he would not have survived if he hadn't built that thing and had that preparedness, if he had been that, you know, the forethought involved. So he is a brilliant man. And then when he's down there, he does his best. He falls in love with his setting a lot more than his wife does. Sissy Spacek's character is probably the best. She plays that role so well of just like, she goes along with it for a point, but then right around 12, like year number 12, she's like, I'm done. You know, like I need to get out. A lot of these movies in the 90s had this, let's see how the 90s compares to previous time periods. You mentioned Back to the Future, you know, 80s, 50s. And then I think of like Austin Powers came out. Is that 97 or so?
Yeah. Late night. Cause I remember seeing Goldmember, which was the last one in like 2002 or 2003, right when it came out. So that would have been late 90s, I believe, for the Austin Powers movies.
And the first one in particular, really, you know, they don't, I mean, I guess throughout the movie is a running theme where he doesn't understand how things have changed in lots of different departments throughout the 90s. But there's a scene in particular where he's like, you know, he apparently goes out and buys a Reebok pump, and he's like pumping it and it blows up in his face, and he's trying to listen to a CD on a record player, and it's, you know, and he doesn't know how it works. And then there's one of my favorite movies of all time, is the Brady Bunch movie, which is also set in LA. And, you know, so Blast from the Past, to explain it, the Brady Bunch, they don't. They're just like this family that's stuck in the early 1970s for some reason. And everybody around them is in the 90s. And they're like, every day is a struggle for the Bradys because they still don't understand the 90s. Like, it's some kind of weird space-time continuum kind of thing. There's a very science fiction-y feel to it. Another one is Frequency, which has a young man, you know, the character in the 90s talking to his dad through a ham radio, in the 60s. Right. And what I'm getting at is, do you think it's odd that probably one of the scariest times in American history, the 1960s, especially the Cold War type stuff, is shown as such a simple time in Blast from the Past? What do you make of that?
Yeah, that is interesting, because it is, you know, I mean, I think we have this tendency as a species, I think, to romanticize the past, and, you know, nostalgia is a very powerful tool. And so we remember the things that we loved or that our parents have told us positively about these time periods. I think about, you know, like growing up in the 80s and 90s, I hated malls. Now I love malls. And I remember like the good parts about them because they're not here anymore to the degree that they were. So there's certainly in this movie, I mean, this is 1962. I was actually surprised when I turned it on and saw 1962, because in my brain, which had not seen the movie in years, but I have the soundtrack, which I listen to more frequently, and it's just a great soundtrack of 90s alternative and 90s throwback swing music, and a little bit of Perry Como, which would have been, you know, old fashioned in the 60s. But in my mind, it was it was definitely the 1950s. You know, the picturing the house and the dad. And so when I saw 1962, I was surprised because it has this kind of late 50s feel in my mind. So all I'd say that it's before, you know, Vietnam really gets heavy, and as the civil rights and these types of things are kind of growing, but it's kind of just on the cusp of some of these big dramatic changes that are kind of leaving the 50s behind and heading into the more turbulent 1960s, where we're really kind of thinking a little bit more critically, and we this kind of era of optimism kind of based on blind consumerism and this kind of championing of American values coming out of the Second World War and in opposition to these communist values, and the Cold War obviously as a setup here. It certainly does poke fun at something that at the time, I'm sure, was quite serious. Like the possibility of nuclear war is not exactly something that people were probably making jokes about at the time. And of course, these fallout shelters are real things. You know, are they as elaborate as this? Certainly not. I had the good fortune of living in Woodstock, Vermont previously. There's a national park there, the Marsh Billings Rockefeller National Historical Park, the only national park in Vermont. But it was owned by Lawrence Rockefeller most recently and his family. And I don't remember exactly when it was built, but at the time that his brother was governor in New York and basically ordered fallout shelters to be built across New York, Lawrence, even though he's over in Vermont in solidarity, builds, you know, a Rockefeller style fallout shelter underneath this home that they live in, one of his many homes, but the home that he lived in there in Woodstock, Vermont. And even a Rockefeller fallout shelter was not as elaborate as the one in this movie. So I doubt there was much quite like the level of sophistication in the movie, but still something that was being built. If we look around our cities today, you still see these yellow and yep. black circles that say Fallout, remnants of where these places still exist and were built around cities to provide escape.
I think about one of my all-time favorite movie is American Graffiti. And mm-hmm. that is, it was made 12 years after 1962, but it says, you know, the question is, where were you in 62? And I think that also, yeah, the things that became synonymous with the 60s hadn't arrived yet. The Beatles hadn't arrived yet. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. JFK was still president. He hadn't been assassinated. You know, it's just like, so every decade, and it's a very 20th century thing, and we're still doing it in the 21st century. We like to measure ourselves in nice, even 10-year increments.
Right.
Very 20th century of, and maybe even before that it started, but I, you know, just like, this is the 60s. And even in the time period, but especially in retrospect, it allows for us like to just dump into one big category. All right, 60s equals flower children and Vietnam right. War stuff and the Black Panthers and, you know, kind of like that TV show that I think was on in the late 90s called The 60s. And mm-hmm. it made it seem like everybody was either a hippie, a Vietnam War vet,
right.
or a Black Panther. There was no other room. And I would, as a kid, you know, so I graduated high school in 1999 when this movie came out. Mm-hmm. And one in particular, we had a homecoming float that we built. It was called Turn Back the Clock. That was the theme of it. And mm-hmm. since we were the class of 99, we had this this dial thing that took the year 99 and flipped it over to 66. And
clever.
It went really fast though. So it was like nobody could actually see what it said, but we knew what it was. And all of my classmates, when we were marching in the parade and getting ready for it and stuff, started dressing up with tie-dye shirts and peace sign headbands and hippies basically. Mm-hmm. And my parents, who were about 18 years old, 1966, my dad was 18 years old. He's like, nobody dressed like that back then in 1966. He's like, and my mom had her old John Lennon leather hat thing, like this beanie hat. And I had just like a turtleneck sweater on. They're like, now you look like you're from 1966. I'm like, really? So I was like, I was the odd man out walking down the street. But my parents, like, yeah, we didn't know anybody. Like, they went to college in New York City and in the late 60s, like at the mm-hmm. height of supposed hippiedom. They're like, we didn't know anybody dressed like that. We didn't know any hippies. That wasn't really something mm-hmm. that took place until, you know, it became popularized anyway until like after Woodstock in 69. So I guess in a way we want to think of the 60s, and by 1999, maybe this movie in a weird way is acting as setting the record straight for all of us, Gen X millennial, you know, I guess millennial would be the target audience, but you know, it's like, no, actually the 60s did have a lot of this in it, and there was a lot of innocence, and there was a lot of, you know, conservatism, and there was, you know, there, it wasn't the wild scene, you know, that Woodstock was maybe perhaps the culmination of the 1960s, but only for a very small part of the society that mm-hmm. most mm-hmm. people were listening to Perry Como, you know, as he is at the beginning. They chose LA. What is it about Los Angeles that makes this the appropriate setting for when they go down, it's one thing, when they come up, it's completely different?
You know, Los Angeles certainly stands in for lots of other places around the country or world. So it certainly would have been possible for the filmmakers to shoot in LA, where many movies do, because it's right there and there are great tax incentives. But they made the decision to keep it in Los Angeles. I think, I mean, there has been, and I think I have at many points in my life kind of bought into this ideology because I grew up watching these movies in the 90s and 2000s, many of which were set in Los Angeles. But I think in the popular culture, because of the time period, well, and also, I mean, factually, from the time period, so much of the architecture and the cultural identity in Southern California, in the popular imagination, is from the 20th century. So we think of Los Angeles as the place with this space age, Jetsons, Googie style 1950s and 60s architecture. And I think that that is played out in the popular culture, thinking of Southern California as a mid-century place that, that has that character. But it is also factually true. And if I want to find a Googie coffee shop in Massachusetts or Vermont or New England here, where you and I both live, we have to hunt. You know, we may find some older diners from the 1920s or 30s, but we don't have the kind of the mid-century stuff that's left, you know, because we as a culture in New England have decided that the time period that we want to represent is, you know, colonial, 1700s, 1600s. So even if we had neon signs or remnants of that mid-century period, we've erased them and created an image of the original, because many of the buildings here were built much before that in Southern California. A lot of those buildings from the mid-century, that is when that area was becoming built up. So those buildings remain. And so because of that, I think it makes sense for a movie about the mid-century to be set in Los Angeles. And as is the case anywhere, you know, it's not like all of the malt shops that used to be there are still there. Right. And Los Angeles is a place that changed dramatically. We can see it there, as in other places, the suburban kind of tract family homes being commercialized over time. Looking at the kind of the car dealership across the street from the punk club in the 90s, where, I mean, it looks, I've been, you know, the most recent times I've been to Los Angeles a few years ago, I mean, it still looks that way. I mean, the place has changed in many ways. So I think Los Angeles in film especially really kind of sits in as the microcosm for change, because Los Angeles also has an image, I think, of constantly reinventing itself.
That's true. That's an absolute great point, because it's been growing, and I think in the 60s, you know, it was growing just as fast as it was throughout the rest of the 20th century. And, you know, to your point before, I mean, if they had set the movie in Boston or something like that, it was, you know, 1962, suburbs of Boston, they go under the ground. They might rise up in 1999, suburbs of Boston, very little. It's not as drastic. And LA had really become, especially throughout the 90s. I mean, you think about the LA riots, before that, of course, you know, the cause for that would be the Rodney King beating and then subsequent trial. And then you have the OJ Simpson car chase. And on top of that, just the way that, unfortunately, Hollywood, both the industry of the movies as well as the actual place, Hollywood, was deteriorating, becoming a lot less stars in their eyes, and, you know, it seemed to be getting seamier and things. You know, people were getting stories from Hollywood about, you know, kind of the creepy things that happened there to, you know, help people's careers. And so I think the attitudes by the 90s about LA, and I'll go back to the Brady Bunch movie with this, the whole opening sequence of that movie is driving through 90s LA, and you see piercing and tattoo shops, people driving their cars in, you know, smog, and, you know, signs saying, you know, gang riot war going on, you know, nice day. You know, they're really demonstrating their knowledge of LA as being this once land of great promise that has declined incredibly before the entire nation and world's eyes. Like that, mm-hmm, even if you've never mm-hmm. been there, you definitely see a different Los Angeles by 1999 than had existed in the earlier part of your lifetime. Time is probably the most critical part in that story of this is what the 90s look like to fresh eyes. Right. So, you know, the last view of the United States, the last view of Los Angeles, California that Calvin ever had was, you know, pre a plane falling on his house, was a really nice view. Right. Everything was perfect. Suburbia. Everything is orderly. Everything was bright, shiny. And then he emerges on one of the rare rainy days in LA.
I know. And... yeah. And the next morning it's beautiful, but I guess it's pouring rain in Los Angeles and in the valley. I said like you would think it would be Skid Row. I mean, the way it's portrayed that this is out in the valley.
Well, and to outside observers, you know, I've been to LA once and it was 6 months ago. So I don't really, and when I was there this past summer, it like things came together a lot more than like I start, oh, that's where, you know, that is in proximity to something else. Cause I'd always just heard the names bandied about in media. Cause like you said before, you know, that's the hub of entertainment. So of course they're going to film as much as they can around that area. And so we've all gotten to know Southern California through way of media. I wouldn't know. I would just kind of have to take this movie's
right
what they're saying is like, yeah, I guess that's what the valley looks like.
Yeah, to the average person, yeah, the valley, you don't know that the valley in Skid Row, it takes you an hour and a half to get from one place to the other if you're not. Yeah, it certainly does seem, you know, I mean, they have, for comedic effect, they, as is often the case, like we use extremes and stereotypes in a way to heighten the difference. Yeah, we have this very quintessential early 1950s suburban kind of paradise, conservative, you know, communist hating, mad scientist coming up in this very extreme version of, you know, of what parts of Los Angeles, you know, would have looked like at the time, in order to show just how different, you know, the message certainly is, you know, society has deteriorated over time. And, you know, despite the fact that, you know, Eve, you know, working in these kind of seedy places and, you know, staying with her friend who lives in, you know, this beautiful craftsman home that would cost, you know, probably $2.5 million now. I mean, then it was maybe only 800,000, but
it's Dave Foley. He could do what he wants. Right. You know? Which I wanted to say, cause we haven't really mentioned any of the other characters very much, but Dave Foley is a chameleon. I mean, that guy can play any character he wanted in the 1990s. I mean, he went from, of course, Kids in the Hall, where that's what he did on the show. I mean, all the guys and Kids in the Hall were constantly looking and sounding different, skit to skit. But then News Radio, he was in the It's Pat movie, which nobody outside of my house has ever seen. But also is another LA movie, you know, because I think cost effective. And, you know, so you get to know a little bit of Los Angeles culture by way of, you know, non-showbusy Los Angeles by way of that movie. He's in, you know, countless other stuff, is this character, that character, but he always is super convincing. And so as Eve's friend that she lives with, they don't really give much about what he does for a living. He must do well, you know, because he
well, hey, web, he builds websites, I remember. Yeah. So he's kind of presented so like early tech guy. Yes, yeah, but I was wondering. I didn't do any research on this, but it felt somewhat early for the trope of, you know, attractive female who lives with her gay best friend.
Yeah,
which At that time, if that was happening,
I remember ahead of its time kind of thing.
Yeah.
I wonder if it was just kind of showing how modern she is, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, mm-hmm. just another way to sneak mm-hmm. in the modern balance to, and, you know, quick little joke where, oh, he's gay. Oh, good for you, you know, because he thinks gay in 1962 just means happy, you know.
Yeah, thanks for being so happy all the time.
And he's like, we try, yeah. So it's like, I think it might have been just a way to 90s it up a little bit more. Like,
a girl
that could easily, you know, in Adams, when they were both born, technically, but definitely when, you know, in his youth, somebody like Eve would have been married by the time, and with several kids, you know, by the time mm-hmm. that they meet. And, mm-hmm. you know, but meanwhile, she's living paycheck to paycheck, taking one crummy job after another, doesn't mm-hmm. seem to have much direction in her life, very Gen X-y, you know, stereotypical mm-hmm. Gen Xer, has extensive knowledge about baseball cards, you know, so she's able to ward him off from selling off his collection for like $100 or something, $1,000 mm-hmm. to that skeezy baseball card guy. You know, so yeah, maybe that whole component of where she lives and with whom was just another way to make sure that it's documenting the 90s properly. I think I'll give this movie another credit. They don't overdo the 90s either. I think that was a trend, especially as we got closer to the millennium, or maybe even more just the early 90s, but they were like, this is the 90s. This is the 90s. Like, we'll have to, you know, like the little girl in Jurassic Park, like, I'm a hacker, you know, like, like I can get into the mainframe, and, you know, there's all this like useless technology that it really dates the movie, which they don't really get into A Blast from the Past. They could have. They don't even mention Y2K. Mm-hmm. I mean, people were supposedly, I don't know how true this is, but I remember people were, you know, reportedly doing a similar Fallout Shelter type thing as we approach the millennium, because mm-hmm. they were afraid that everything would just fall apart and they would need to survive on their own for a while, off the grid and all that business. So that might be another reason why this movie was made in the first place. It's just kind of like, hey, we've mm-hmm. been here before. Don't let this happen to your kids. You know, if you go under the ground for a while, you know, you might be running after fool's gold here. Interesting about the audience is that there are actually two versions of this movie that were put out on VHS. One is the original theatrical release, and the other one it's an edited version. I think it got a lower rating, a PG rating, versus the original, which might have been PG-13. And that in itself kind of tells you who they were directing it for. They had all the elements, as we were just saying, with Eve's character in particular and her way of life. They had all the elements of a Gen X crowd movie, but by trying to make it so that it can be delivered to a younger audience, what does that tell you about that time period of the late 90s, early 2000s, that they made a almost like a kid's version of the same film?
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I did not know that fact. I do remember watching it and thinking the language was stronger than I remember. Yeah.
Especially the baseball card scene.
Right. Yeah. I have an F-bomb and maybe you need two of them before you get an R rating or something. And it certainly doesn't feel like an R-rated movie. I think the 90s were a time, you know, even in the late 90s when we're, you know, there's still this concern about kind of the corruption, you know, corruption of the youth, and, you know, the satanic panic and all of these things are, you know, a decade earlier, but there's remnants, I think of that. And it may just be, you know, the PG movies do well. I mean, I think there is this kind of, there's a, I can understand the impetus to kind of highlight the innocence. I mean, in a way, the message of the movie, one of the messages as I see it, is that there's a place even in this crazy jaded world for optimism and politeness and seeing the good in the world. And that is, you know, a message I think that can be appealing for a PG audience. I mean, the cynical side of me says, well, you know, you do what you need to do to get the rating that you think is going to bring in the cash.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's part of it.
The family viewing edition, as it's called, came out in 2001. So 2 years after the movie's release, but that just tells me that, yeah, the uplifting version of, you know, that component of the story is what they really wanted to go for. And I don't know if it came out. I'm assuming that the odds are it came out before 9/11. But you know, we oftentimes forget the kinds of problems that the country and the society and the culture faced pre 9/11 as well. Mm-hmm. You're mentioning, I mean, one of the things in 1999, that really set the tone for, you know, especially for youth, was the Columbine massacre. Mm-hmm. And people were immediately looking at the media relationship with that and with Marilyn Manson music. And I mean, he was gone after as if it was him involved directly in it, as being like a component of it. And that satanic panic thing that you're referring to definitely extends to him. He was... He was, and that kind of music. And so, yeah, the youth rebellion that we were hinting at before, that really started in the late 60s, was extended in its own way throughout the 90s. You know, we were both, like you said, we were both in high school in that era. So we remember the way that, especially with the internet showing up, you know, parents were concerned. They wanted to try to find ways to, get us on the right track to make sure that we were heading into adulthood with our head on our shoulders and, you know, everything is as best as it could. And this movie is a good vehicle for that, because it definitely takes jabs at the saccharine sweet Americana of the late 50s, early 60s throughout it. I mean, Adam does come across as a big goof a lot throughout the film. And, but it also, and definitely by the end of the movie, Calvin is like really creepy. You know, if you find a girl, bring her down. You know, he's like, whoa, you know, it's going on here. But when they bring it all around, you know, they make a point of saying, yeah, the Cold War ended without a shot being fired. We were still in that age. Again, I'll reiterate, pre 9/11, so the era from end of Cold War to it was mainly just domestic issues of people, you know, cults and domestic terrorism and that kind of stuff was happening. So it was like, let's use this as an incubator in a way to get these kids. You know, yeah, we recognize the goofiness, the cheesiness, if you will, of the time period that we're showing you here, but at the same time there's a lot of merit in their wisdom, and that you shouldn't necessarily reject it altogether.
Right Yeah, that I mean, the last line of the movie is something to the effect of, you know, he still says, Eve is talking and about Adam, and he still has these, you know, naive ideas, but I sometimes just don't tell him, because why break his spirit or something? Because like the message is like, yeah, this kind of saccharine view of the world may not be accurate, but maybe there's something to it, and you know, don't let our kind of crumbling modern society break your spirit. And I mean, as I'm thinking about it more, it makes sense in this time period of, you know, in the 90s, stickered CDs because there's bad words. I mean, there is this kind of sense I remember from my, you know, from growing up in the kind of religious culture that I was a part of, and still maintain some of that. But there was an element that like that bad words and sex are the things that are going to ruin you. So if you take those few bad words out of this movie, you know, you take the mention of sex out of it, and it can be seen as a parable for kind of a 1960s version of clean living as the way to go. And I certainly remember the culture of, you know, the bleeped out versions of the song. You can still have the thing, but just take out the problematic elements of it. And I don't know that has totally, I think that still exists today, but not to the degree I feel like it did at that period.
The last thing I want to bring up, and I want to see if you think this still works in the movie or not, is the club scene, the nightclub scene, where they go to a place that for some reason is just called Club 40s. And welcome to Club 40s. You know, they have a Humphrey Bogart impersonator, I assume, is introducing, maybe every 10 minutes he gets up there and does his thing about welcome to Club 40s. And then it's swing music is going on, which swing revival was in full swing in 1999. I mean, and so it's like, it's kind of funny because, you know, Adam gets to demonstrate two of his skills that you see in development as a kid, fighting and dancing in the same club, same night. But I'm just curious, why do you think they launch him back 20 years before he was born into Club 40s? Like, what do you think, there's anything to that, or are they just riding that trend of swing music coming back?
Yeah, now that is fascinating. I hadn't thought of that component, and as looking back into the soundtrack, I was made like a quarter of the soundtrack is swing music. And I certainly remember that time. Like, and I'm in middle school, high school, so at my most kind of impressionable time around pop culture, and hearing this swing music appear and feeling like, oh man, what is this? Like 1940s stuff music, coming back. And I didn't love it at the time. And I think it works from a story perspective too. You know, we see him in the fallout shelter learning to fight from his dad. His mom comes in and takes him away and teaches him how to dance, and then dad comes back in and cuts to mom and dad dancing, and he sees this as and I think this is kind of the first time that they show him kind of longing for love when he sees his mom and dad dancing. So it's a way to kind of pull those strands together. He sees his mom and dad dancing and falling in love. He's then falling in love with Eve himself all these years later, and shows this kind of quintessential masculine and feminine skills that he learned while underground as a way to put them on display. In the way that swing music is almost more of a throwback, you know, in the 60s, you know, he's learning how to do this dancing, not because it's what the kids of 1962 are learning. His parents who were growing up and listening to this music and learning this kind of dancing are teaching him how to do this 1940s dancing that they learned when they were teenagers to him in the 60s and 70s. And so it's a way to kind of tie all of that together, and for him to show off his skills. If he had gone to a modern dance club, it would have had to be, you know, I think of Night at the Roxbury, the 90s club scene. That would have been a fish out of water scene, placing it in there.
I'd be curious to see if they had a previous rendition of the script that had him going to a different club, and then suddenly that swing music culture, that big band revival showed up and the writer's like, oh, perfect. I'll just stick them in here. Yeah. Because that works.
Yeah.
Cause there's also from the same time period, that movie with Vince Vaughn and John Favreau, Swingers, in which dabbles, you know, at the very end of that. And there was, you know, particularly places like LA, there was a 1940s subculture that existed among Gen Xers in that era, that they were dressing like, you know, the zoot suits, or at least elements of that. And, you know, predating, going even before rock and roll, you know, looks to them.
Yeah.
And I remember quizzing my wife on that one time. You know, we were just kind of joking about, yeah, remember when swing music came back for a couple minutes in the 90s? Like, what was that all about? And she's like, well, it makes sense. She's like, we were fascinated by not our parents. Like, we'd already gotten pretty bombarded with our parents' time period of 60s and 70s stuff. We were, especially since our grandparents were aging on and probably passing away, and, you know, the Greatest Generation people were like fascinating with their youth. And so even if it is, and I'm with you on that, like, I was not taken away by the modern, you know, with Brian Setzer, I'm like, stick with the Stray Cats. I'm not, you know, huge on your orchestra, and same thing with, you know, all the other, you know, neo swing groups, but because they were very 90s, it was just blaring music, and it just was not as easygoing as the 40s was, but it does make sense. We're like, so it might not have been handpicked for that movie, Necessary Blast from the Past. It may have been more like, yeah, we have, you know, a greater trend going on of, you know, you're not the only one who is a holdover from another era. Let's, you know, you're even kind of a fish out of water, and this, you know, but like you said, he's learning from his parents. I mean, he's basically a product of the 1960s in stasis. Like, he never actually gets influenced or informed by any other time period. So,
And
I just thought I'd bring that up because I it's like a pretty big scene. And especially since that's when Eve starts to fall for him. You know, when she sees him out on the floor, you know, with the two women, and gets all jealous and stuff.
Really, there might be something to this. I mean, certainly it's set up as if nobody expects him to succeed. You know, he goes over to talk to the women, and they fully expect, you know, Troy, the friend, says, I, you know, I don't know if I can watch this. And they fully expect it to go horribly. And are surprised. I'll say this impetus still exists. I was interested when I was living in Milwaukee. I met some folks from the Milwaukee Vintage Style Society, a group, you know, Milwaukee, certainly not Los Angeles, but a group of folks who regularly get together, you know, or many of whom wear clothing from the 20s, 30s, 40s on a regular basis and get together to kind of celebrate this era. And a whole other topic, but I think it is interesting, you know, the time periods that we pick to romanticize, or how, you know, this nostalgia for the 40s that's coming out in the 90s, of course, I think then continues to accelerate. And within, you know, 5 or 10 years, the whole kind of growth of hipster culture, I think, is going back another 20, 30 years to the late 1800s, early 1900s, where we're really romanticizing mustaches and
barbershops
and newsies hats and this kind of this search for, I think we always have this search for authenticity, and we go back to the time when we believe that authenticity existed and look for ways to try to recreate it.
Well, what a better era than 1999. I mean, you can't think of a better time period than 1999 for them to do that, because it's like a decade, a century, I should say, a century in review. You know, we're looking back on the 20th century, and we're taking from it and trying to prepare for the next one and the next millennium.
It's certainly interesting to think about. You know, my mind immediately goes to, like, holy cow, this movie was 25 years ago now. And like, well, what does that look like now? And, you know, doing the math, you know, so there's 30, the movie says that it's 35 years. So I guess it's made in 1999, but I guess maybe it's supposed to be set in 97. But if we say, you know, 37 years, you know, back from today, mm-hmm. is 1987. So like if we were making this movie yep. now, what would it look like for someone to go underground in 1987 and come back up in 2024? And in my mind, because like, because I was alive then, and I was only five, but or four.
There's probably five. Something like that on Netflix that we just don't know about. Yeah.
What would it look like?
I'll actually end with this. I just looking up something. It said I saw a article from Variety from last year. It said Alicia Silverstone is interested in a Blast from the Past 2.
That's exactly
what they would do with it.
Yes,
they pick up where they left off. And I mean, we're in 90s nostalgia era anyway. Every, you know, fashion yes. is, and people are seem to be really interested in 90s stuff. So that might be something, and maybe this podcast will inspire them to actually go for it.
They made a good burger too. If they can make a good burger too.
They can make a good burger too. They can
make a Blast from the Past.
Even if it's direct to Hulu or something like that. But Jeremy, thank you again for joining. I had a great time. I had a blast talking about Blast from the Past. So thank you once again for being on the EPS podcast, where everything, including 1999's Blast from the Past, is a primary source. Talk to you next time.
Please rate and follow this podcast wherever you are listening to it right now, and share with everyone you know. You can follow the Everything is a Primary Source podcast on social media, including YouTube and especially Instagram. Show notes, which expound on each episode, and essays about history and pop culture can be found on Substack. The hub for all these things is everything-history.com. Thank you for listening to the EPS podcast, where everything is a primary source.